Good afternoon. This is the LaRue Show, April 12th, 2008. And I might add, it was 63 years ago today that one of our great presidents, Franklin Roosevelt, died. So we have a lot of work to do to continue in his tradition. We have a very special edition of the LaRue Show. Our guest today in the studio is the ambassador from Zimbabwe to the United States, Dr. Maparanga. And on the joining us from Berlin, Germany, as one of the leaders of our youth movement, Portia Turumbwe. And so we will be having a discussion this afternoon on what is going on in Africa and in Zimbabwe. I think I might just frame the discussion a little bit in terms of what the global picture looks like. And this was discussed by Mr. LaRouche this past Thursday, when he met with a group of foreign diplomats in Washington, D.C. And the conditions now that we're seeing around the world is the meltdown of the global financial system. And under these conditions, the British financiers located in the city of London are looking for control during this meltdown to try to save their system. And we're seeing a series of destabilizations, potentially leading to wars that are being instigated by the British across the globe. Certainly in Africa, in their attacks on Zimbabwe, their operations to support the Dalai Lama against the country of China, provocations against Russia. And the British policies are to try to find a way for themselves to survive in a system that is dead. And this financial system cannot be brought back to life. It is finished. And the only thing is a new one, which Mr. LaRouche and our friends around the world in the United States are working to create. Now, today, we will focus on the situation in Africa and Zimbabwe, and we're very fortunate to have the ambassador here. Very good for you to be here.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is just start off with some very preliminary questions, Mr. Ambassador. Today is 2 weeks since the Zimbabwe election for president and for parliament. Could you bring us up to date in terms of where we are in this process?
Right. thank you, Larry. You know, these elections are actually the culmination of a process that started last year in March, when the heads of state and government of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, met and they issued a declaration or a communique in which they, among other things, they requested the president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, to play the part of facilitator, mm-hmm. some say even mediator, in talks between the ruling party, ZANU-PF, and the opposition, MDC. So many meetings were held, both in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, through Thabo Mbeki's mediation. And it bore fruit. Mm-hmm. These talks resulted in amendment number 18
Correct, yeah.
to the Zimbabwean constitution, because all along we have been having, we've been operating under the Lancaster House constitution that was given to us by the British at the end of the protracted war of liberation. It lasted 14 years. And then we proceeded to Lancaster House for the peace conference, and that resulted in a constitution that we are operating on under to this day. Now, amendment number 18, agreed upon by the parties involved, it cut the presidential term from 6 to 5. Mm-hmm. And it also stipulated that there would be a maximum of 2 terms. Mm-hmm. Because previously, we were following the British practice that there is no term limit mm-hmm. to the chief executive officer. The Prime Minister of Britain has no term limits.
Mm-hmm,
right. In the United States, you operated for a long, long time since the Declaration of your Independence without term limits until 1959, I think. I think the great Roosevelt, I think when he died, he must have been in his third or fourth term.
Fourth term.
Yes. So that was the other provision of Amendment number 18. But the other one that is germane to your question is has to do with the conduct of elections. Previously, there were three or four bodies that were involved in preparations for elections. We had the Register General's Office, you had a Delimitation Commission, and then you had an Electoral Council or something. All these, their functions were now concentrated in one body that was created, known as the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. This commission has both members nominated by the opposition party and members nominated by the ruling party,
mm-hmm,
on a
right.
50-50 basis.
I think there's two for each.
Yes, right. And then there's a chairman. The chairman is appointed in accordance with the procedure, governing the appointment of judges, that is appointed on the recommendation of the Judiciary Services Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So really, malicious talk of this talk that the commission is biased or something like that is not true, because the composition was made on a bipartisan basis. You have in the commission, as I said, nominees of the ruling party and nominees of the opposition party. Now, previously, we used to have our presidential elections and parliamentary elections separately. That one of the agreements in the Mbeki talks was that these elections have to be harmonized, that they should be held simultaneously. In fact,
right.
there are four elections in one. We're talking of the local government elections for
right.
the councils, the presidential election,
right.
election for the Senate,
right.
and elections for the House of Assembly. All four in one. And so this is something that was unprecedented in our
sure.
history.
Right.
And previously, when we held elections, we would get our full results within 2 or 3 days.
Right.
But this time around, it has taken a bit longer. After five days, we got all the results of the House of Assembly. And then after 2 more days, we got the results of the Senate, and we get all the results now in the local government election, but we still do not have the full results in the presidential
right.
election, because there are two processes here involved. First, the results of the election were posted at the polling station for everybody to see.
Correct.
And then they were transmitted to the National Collation Center
mm-hmm.
to be centralized and
right.
Collated. And then there you have the process of collation, and we're talking of results from 9,000 polling stations.
Right.
And so there's collation, and then the second process is that of verification.
Right.
Now, in the other three elections, the Senate, the House, and the local government, these processes have been concluded. in the presidential election, they are still in the process of verification.
Right.
And your viewers may have noted that the ruling party had some complaints to make because in several areas, the results posted at the polling station did not tally with the results that were received by the National Coalition Center. And these anomalies have to be addressed. So this is where we are now. But because the process has taken more than a week to to get the full results, the British and their surrogates, that is the opposition MDC, are claiming that their presidential candidate had won, even though the Electoral Commission, the ZEC, has not yet concluded its task. And we think that, this is a recipe for disorder. People should not declare themselves winners before the authorized body does that.
I understand. The the votes have not been officially released for the president, yet there are people in the MDC and others around the world claiming that Morgan Tsvangirai, the presidential candidate for the Movement for Democratic Change, won the election. How can anyone claim that if the votes aren't come out yet?
Yeah, the for one to win the presidential election, he has to get 51% of the vote. And when the Secretary General of the MDC addressed a press conference, he said, we have done our own collation of the vote from all the constituencies, from the polling stations, and we reckon that our candidate has won 50.3% of the vote.
Right.
And they said that President Mugabe had won maybe 44% of the vote. But the important thing to notice here is that even by their own reckoning, their candidate has not attained the 51% that the Constitution stipulates as as the threshold.
So if people who are always talking about the rule of law being followed, the rule of law in Zimbabwe is that a candidate has to get 51%. If
yes.
If not, then there would be a runoff.
Yes.
So this is where we stand on the presidential. Now, while we're speaking here today, there's been an emergency meeting of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, has been called in Zambia to deal with this. But maybe you could give us some background as to why this meeting was called and what you expect to happen at it.
Right. You probably will have noticed that when President Thabo Mbeki was on his way to the summit, the Africa India summit, I think, he passed through London, and he had discussions with Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
Right.
And when he came out of those discussions, he was asked a question on Zimbabwe and the election there, and he said, "No, we have to be patient because the ZEC has to do its job thoroughly."
Right.
He could not understand why there was so much almost panic or whatever impatience, and you probably have noticed that only yesterday he was having a meeting with President Mugabe in Harare, and he was saying to news reporters that there is no crisis in Zimbabwe. We have the results of three elections, and we are awaiting the final results of the fourth election, which is the presidential. And the ZEC has made it clear, and the chairman of the ZEC has said it on several occasions, that his body wants to make a meticulous collation of the results so that we do not have a situation where the results are gainsaid or second-guessed, and we have a Kenyan-type situation of post-election violence. So this is what they're trying to avert. And so, the British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, and I think that the Department of State here also in the United States, they have been leaning on the leaders of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to say that they must put pressure on the ZEC to release the results. And the ZEC is saying, we cannot release incomplete results. We are still in the process of verification.
Well, when you say that they're putting pressure on them, I think that's diplomatically well put. There's a lot of intimidation going on, I believe, at this point, because of Prime Minister Gordon's attitude towards Zimbabwe. I think, additionally, we should look at this situation in Zimbabwe from a larger historical standpoint. And I think this is what most people, mm-hmm. especially Americans, refuse to look at history, as mm-hmm. if history has any relevance to what's going on today.
Yeah, yeah,
and, of course, the baby boomers think history began in the 1950s when they were born.
Right.
But even other people don't think that history actually is a force and that acts on the present. And I think it'd be important to realize that the people of Zimbabwe and President Mugabe fought a very tough, long war, 14-year war of liberation, against one of the most racist, imperialist regimes of the British Empire we've ever seen in southern Rhodesia. And I don't think they've ever forgiven President Mugabe or the Zimbabwe people for becoming independent. In fact, I don't think today they think they're independent. They still think they're under the British Empire.
Well, if you listen to some of the debates that go on in the House of Lords, when from time to time they debate Zimbabwe, you would get convinced that as far as they are concerned, Zimbabwe is not yet an independent sovereign state. And to understand this, you have to go back slightly to into history. If you peruse the Colonial Office documents that are kept in the Public Record Office in London, in Kew Gardens, you will see that Southern Rhodesia, which is Zimbabwe now,
right,
and South Africa, along with Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, these five,
right,
they are referred to as white man's country. That's the phrase. That is the phrase that is used consistently by the great administrators, Lord Salisbury, Lord Milner, right. Sir Harry Johnston. They all refer to these five as white man's country. It's a policy that was predicated on two sub policies, or it rested on two pillars. First, the British settlers who went to these countries were supposed to eventually outnumber the natives,
right?
And because these five were earmarked for permanent white settlement, and of course this policy succeeded completely in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And it was well on its way to success in South Africa and Southern Rhodesia,
right,
Zimbabwe now, because they, in the course of years, they radically changed the ratio between the natives and the incoming settlers.
Right.
As we speak now, in South Africa, the ratio is 1 to 10, where 3 centuries ago, previously, it was 1 to 19,000. In my country, it was
one being
one European to 19,000 natives.
And now it's one European to 10.
Now it's 1 to 10, yes,
okay,
in South Africa. In Zimbabwe, when the British South Africa Company colonized the the country in 1890. 4 years later, we have figures which showed, in 1894, showing that in their estimation, there was one white man to 17,000 natives.
Right.
But at the height of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, which lasted from 1953 to 1963, in 1961, the ratio had been changed to 1 to 13.
Right.
You see, so that is that's one aspect of this policy. The other aspect has to do with land alienation.
Right.
In all the five countries, the natives were removed from their land.
Correct.
And herded into native areas. In Zimbabwe, these were called native reserves.
Right.
I grew up in a native reserve
you
myself.
Did?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Which comprised not more than 25% of the land. The other 75 to 85% was now in British hands. We had been totally removed.
Similar to Kenya.
That happened also in Kenya, but not to that extent.
Right.
In Kenya, it was only what they called the White Highlands.
Correct.
These were the highlands which were cool and regarded as good for white settlement.
Right.
So, this explains why, while the rest of Africa, British Africa, was being given independence on a silver platter, or maybe after a few demonstrations or some strike action, in Zimbabwe we had to fight a liberation war for 14 years.
Yes.
Because they said this is not black man's territory.
From 1965 to 1979.
In 1966 to 1979, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it was a very brutal battle.
Yes. And as you know, at the Lancaster House conference, the peace conference, these talks almost broke down on the question of land.
Correct.
The liberation movements, they were packing their bags to go back to the bush to resume the war. When Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher said, "Now I have a compromise proposal, because we will not insist that you buy the land," because they were insisting that the new government of an independent Zimbabwe will have to buy the land from the British settlers.
Right.
And they were saying, no, this land was not bought from our ancestors. It was an act of booty. It was taken from us.
Of course.
And we have fought a liberation war. We must get back the land. We cannot pay for this land. It's ours.
Right.
But we can pay for the developments on the land. If, say, the British farmer had built a dam or has tobacco barns or whatever development has gone on the farm, a court will assess the value of that development,
of that improvement.
And then the government will have to pay compensation for that,
right,
but not buying the land. So this was the compromise agreement. And
the compromise was that the British and Americans would buy the land.
Yes, because President Jimmy Carter, this was conveyed to us by Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, saying that they also will step in,
right,
and make a contribution to a land reform program. And indeed, Margaret Thatcher did pay money for what they called the inception phase,
right,
of the land reform program.
Mm-hmm.
But when her party was defeated in elections in 1989.
Yeah.
They by the Labour Party of Tony Blair. The new party said that they were not beholden to promises,
right,
made by the Conservative Party of Margaret,
right,
Thatcher, and so this was conveyed to us by the letter from Claire Short, the Secretary for
the Foreign Office.
Yes, for the Foreign
the colonial
office.
The old
Correct.
Colonial Office, right?
And in that she said that this is a new government, and we cannot honor the promises made by the
right.
old government, and so the government of Zimbabwe was constrained to amend the constitution in order to make it legal for the government to appropriate land.
To give to
for
the
redistribution, yes.
I think the point that should be clear is that Tony Blair said, we're not going to participate in this anymore. And therefore, what the current government did was give the land to the 12 to 15 million Zimbabweans who were living on reserves. And this is, I think, what drove the British sort of over the deep end in 2000 to escalate their campaigns against President Mugabe in Zimbabwe.
Right. So when we launched the land reform program, we were not actually saying we don't want the British share. We were saying let us share this land equitably.
Right.
Even as we speak now, we have British farmers still
right.
in Zimbabwe. It's not like they've all been expelled.
Right.
But before the land reform program, we used to have the second largest number of white farmers in Africa after South Africa.
Right.
Because we have insisted on one man, one farm policy,
mm-hmm.
the number of white farmers has gone down, and now we are number three in the whole of Africa. Number one is South Africa. Number two is Namibia. We are number three, and Kenya's number four
right.
in terms of the numbers of white farmers.
I understand.
Right.
Portia, would you like to jump in with some questions for the ambassador?
Well, not as yet. I have a comment because in the organizing here in Europe, also around these issues, what I've noticed is that the reason why people do not understand what is going on in Zimbabwe or do not understand, the key historical issue of this land question is because they just really don't know who the enemy is, on the one hand. And then, that leads to the fact that they don't know what they should be fighting for. And I'm talking now on an international scale because, as we speak, what is also making the headlines, especially here in Europe, is the food crisis and the massive inflation of food, which is causing riots and unrest all across the globe, and people have been killed as a result. And, I mean, people are already dying on an enormous scale, but the fact that you see food riots in over 33 countries, I mean, this is the breakdown of civilization, and it's only the beginning. And for anybody who has a sense of what LaRouche is talking about when he says that the international financial and monetary system is dead, and that the central banks are now just pumping money in a hopeless attempt to deal with this, then where all this is coming from. They've created a huge inflation on the food because the speculators said, people are always going to have to eat something so we could make a profit. And they don't really care much about the suffering that this produces. They're for globalization and free market economy. And what has happened is that countries that were the leading exporters of grain and wheat have just said, no, we're not going to go to market because our people have to eat too, So the market for food has totally run dry. And this has to do with, Al Gore's fascist biofuel policy, where suddenly everybody has to stop climate change and drive a car that uses ethanol where, I heard that apparently most cars actually cannot even use these biofuels anyway, but all the food production was diverted to this piece of nonsense, and then the food that was used there was not eaten by people. And the other side to this thing is that even farmers that thought that they could make a killing on this, they did literally, but they ended up paying inflated prices for animal feed, and so in the end it just did not tally. They didn't gain anything, and this is really a crime against humanity. And so if you can understand this, if you can see the face of the enemy in this whole question, then you'll also get why the media are so hyped up about Zimbabwe. Because any government that tries to go against globalization or the IMF or the British Empire, it's all one thing. They'll get crushed. And it's part of an operation, really, to perpetrate genocide. And you know, you have these horrible quotes by Prince Philip. He's the royal consort, or the royal pervert. He wrote in a book from 1988 called Down to Earth. You know, he basically describes how, you know, you have to reduce the population by starvation, wars, disease. And, you know, this is really, really disgusting stuff. And so you get to a situation where what the Zimbabwean government has been trying to address or redress in this land reform issue has been, you know, this policy. And I was wondering if Dr. Mapranga could also go into that a little bit, this whole question of the British Empire.
Right. In the case of Zimbabwe, the economy, you have to understand that the economy that we inherited was an integral part of the Anglo-American economy.
Correct.
And so very vulnerable to sanctions. When we launched the land reform program, the British prevailed on their allies in the European Union and the Bush administration to impose sanctions on Zimbabwe. If you talk about sanctions with people from the from the British government or the State Department here, they will say, "Oh, we have targeted sanctions," which is not true. They're only referring, in the case of the USA here, they're referring to the executive order that is made by the president every year, in which he lists the leadership, the Zimbabwe leadership, that is forbidden to come to the United States, and whose properties may have been, you know, nationalized or frozen or whatever. They will not talk about the real sanctions which were imposed by Congress in 2001, because Congress passed a law called, the acronym is ZIDERA, that is Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act,
right,
by which the Secretary of the Finance, you know, instructed all the directors who are U.S. citizens, wherever they are, in the Bretton Woods institutions, in the international finance houses and so forth, to block Zimbabwe's access to loans, to credits, to, you know, debt forgiveness and so forth. So they really put this squeeze on the economy. And that also happened in Europe. And so, and that explains why Zimbabwe cannot even raise, you know, loans on the global market because of these sanctions. And these sanctions were part of what Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, when he was addressing the House of Commons in 1994, and also in 2004. Saying that our policy towards Zimbabwe is regime change. In other words, they are funding the opposition.
Correct.
And this is not a secret. You wish to visit the website of the Westminster Foundation. The three parties in the British Parliament, the Liberals, the Labour Party, and the Tories, or the Conservative Party, they vie with each other to make contributions to the MDC and the what they call civil society, the non-governmental organisations, NGOs in Zimbabwe that are opposed to the government. Here in the United States, you need to read the 2007 report of the Department of State. They give a global report on human rights.
Right.
Now, if you go to the section on Zimbabwe, they say the government spent money on the opposition and the civil society organizations that are opposed to the government. So they are coordinating their efforts for what they call regime change.
That's
and maybe this explains why the The British, more than anybody else, have been more in very much interested in the outcome of the Zimbabwe elections, because they wanted the party which they are sponsoring to win the mm-hmm. elections.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can only add to that that in the International Herald Tribune, there was an article yesterday discussing another issue, which is very telling, especially right now that they're coming out with this, is that they talk about Zimbabwe as the treasure trove for mm-hmm. miners. That you know, it's a pedagogical example that I like to use to get people to understand also the land issue in Zimbabwe. If you have the image of two maps, and if you can imagine, you know, a great belt of mineral deposits running through the center of Zimbabwe, you know, diagonally across over 500 kilometers, with just about everything you can think of, you know, gold, silver, platinum, nickel, tin, etc. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. You know, they were saying, you know, we would love to come in and start mining again, mm-hmm. because you know this for us is an absolute dream. And then you think of the land distribution in Rhodesia since about, you know, the 1930s until we gained independence. You have another map, you know, where the white Europeans where they had their farms, as Dr. Baprango was saying, they had the richest soil, you know, which is, if you superimpose these two maps where you have most of the mineral deposits, and then with this other map of where they had the land that they gave to the white Rhodesians, this is exactly the same, you know, it's one thing on top of the other, right? And this is why this land reform question is also very contentious, because this is not just, you know, in Zimbabwe, even Francophone countries in Africa, they realize that if the British are successful in recolonizing Zimbabwe through this, you know, their puppet opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, then the rest of Africa is even more vulnerable. And that's why they actually supported President Mugabe being at the Lisbon summit, the EU-Africa summit last December. They insisted he actually be there because he represents a principle now more than ever of the resistance to imperialism, especially British imperialism. And no country that's had a taste of you know, what freedom is like wants to go back to that. And this is another reason why the British hate Zimbabwe so much.
And I could add here, sure, and say they have led a campaign of vilification, in the sense that, well, they gave us the Lancaster House Constitution. The first elections in Zimbabwe were organized and supervised by the last governor of the British, Lord Soames. Mm-hmm. And they said these elections were free and fair, and Mr. Robert Mugabe and your party, you have won. Please form the government of the first government of an independent Zimbabwe.
Great.
And they placed Prime Minister Robert Mugabe and his party on a pedestal of praises. Mm-hmm. He says this is the paragon of democracy, of a statesman, and even Her Majesty the Queen gave him a knighthood. Mm. And Zimbabwe was held as the, right, you know, as the paragon of democracy. But once the land reform program was launched, they embarked on, you know, a campaign of vilification to say there is no democracy in Zimbabwe. Right. This is a dictatorship. Right. This is a tyranny. Now, you know, when the Zimbabwean people decided that there is need for a new constitution now,
right,
that reflects the Zimbabwean reality, because all along we've been operating under the Lancaster House, the British constitution,
right,
they set up a constitutional commission which traveled the length and breadth of the country, soliciting the views of Zimbabweans in all walks of life. That was in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And they held a referendum on a draft constitution. Now, the British did not like that draft constitution because it had a clause that empowered government to redistribute land.
Right.
And so they and their puppets, the MDC,
right,
they campaigned against, that time the MDC had not yet been formed, but it was the labor movement,
right,
and they campaigned against that that constitution, and in the referendum, the ruling party lost the referendum.
Correct, yeah.
And when the MDC was formed, the first election in which they participated in, they won 57 seats,
right,
to the ruling party's 63, a mere difference of 6 seats,
right,
making it the largest parliamentary opposition,
correct,
party,
yeah,
in the whole of Africa.
Right.
And as we speak now, the ruling party has lost control of the House,
right,
of Assembly.
Correct.
It has control of the Senate,
right,
but it has lost control of the House of Assembly. Now, I'm giving you all these examples. Now, would that happen in a dictatorship or in a tyranny? It can only happen in a democracy.
Well, I think it's actually worse than that, Mr. Ambassador, because, you see, the point is that I think the Americans are so naive about understanding who our real enemy is. Because actually the enemy that's trying to destroy the United States is the same British enemy that Zimbabwe is fighting. And this is a complete hypocrisy and a fraud. But through popular opinion, they continue to turn out the propaganda against President Mugabe in Zimbabwe. All you have to look is to about a year ago, not quite, but almost a year ago, there were elections in Nigeria, which everybody admits were a complete fraud. And to this day, the president of Nigeria, Yar'Adua, is now going through the last appeal of those elections to the Supreme Court of Nigeria. So the elections are still under question for almost a year, and everybody knew they were a fraud, and the opposition was wiped out without giving any vote at all. There's no mention of this. The point is that because they're not really concerned about democracy and about elections, the policy, as Portia went through, is a policy of genocide. This is the policy of our government, no later than 1974, when Henry Kissinger wrote National Security Study Memorandum 200. The British Empire wants control of the resources, especially in the financial collapse now. They want that wealth that Portia was talking about. And they are enraged that they are losing control of the land in Zimbabwe. And they're very much afraid, I believe, and you may have more than this, they're afraid of losing the land in South Africa next. And I believe that the great deal of the effort being put to break Zimbabwe is in preparation to do the same thing in South Africa over the period of 2008 leading up to their elections in 2009.
Yes, I think that is a valid point. You know, the principle that was agreed upon at the Lancaster House Conference, and which was implemented for 20 years, was called the willing seller, willing buyer,
right,
principle. And it did not succeed in making a substantial redress to the imbalance in land ownership. And this is the same principle that was adopted by Democratic South Africa and also by Namibia when it gained independence in 1990. And in both countries, in Namibia and South Africa, the government has declared that the principle is not working.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a conscious and proactive policy to redress the colonial imbalance. And in both countries, they have started, government has started appropriating land for redistribution to the landless.
Oh, really?
So they are actually following in the footsteps of the Zimbabwean experience. And perhaps this is, I think this is the reason why these countries have been giving solidarity,
mm-hmm,
to the people of Zimbabwe, because As Portia was saying, you remember the EU-AU summit in Lisbon?
Right.
The British were saying, we are not going there if Zimbabwe is coming.
Right.
And they were trying to persuade all their colleagues to say, don't hold this summit if Zimbabwe is going
right.
to be there.
I remember.
But the whole of Africa said, if Zimbabwe is excluded, we are not coming to that summit. And the summit was held in Lisbon, and lo and behold, who was not there? Only Britain. Only Britain. The whole of Europe was there. The whole
right.
of Africa was there.
Right.
Only Britain, was absent. So this bilateral quarrel that we have with the British, they have tried to internationalize it by soliciting the support of their allies in the EU and North America.
Mm-hmm.
So, so far, Africa has shown tremendous solidarity with the people of Zimbabwe.
And do you think that, what do you think will come out of this SADC conference this weekend? Because obviously it's an attempt to pressure the SADC countries, which are the neighbors of Zimbabwe. But on the other hand, this is a sovereign question for the people of Zimbabwe to settle
right.
the outcome
yes.
of their election.
I think what is going to happen is that there is going to be a debriefing session. By this I mean that at the Dar es Salaam summit last year in March, these heads of state and government gave a mandate to President Thabo Mbeki. Now he has to report to them
I see.
To say, this is what I've done, and the process culminated in elections, and this is where we are now. And on the basis of the report by President Thabo Mbeki, they will have to make a determination on what the SADC region has to do.
And when do you think that report would come out?
The meeting is today,
correct?
Saturday, we hope that by Monday we should know what the outcome was
mm-hmm.
of the meeting. Yes, and incidentally also on Monday we are awaiting the pronouncement by the by Judge Uchena, Justice Uchena. Handled the case of the opposition MDC. They appealed to the court to say that they want an immediate release of the results. And Zach was saying, but we cannot release results which we don't have. We are still working on the results.
Right.
And in any case, we believe that you do not have the competence to make a determination on this matter, because there is an electoral court, and the electoral court, which is in the constitution, is the court that was also agreed upon in the Mbeki mediated talks. There's an electoral court where those who are aggrieved in any election
mm-hmm.
make their appeals
right.
too. But Justice Uchena said. He belongs to the High Court. He said even the High Court has jurisdiction on these matters.
Mm-hmm.
So he is seized of the issue. He has already made that pronouncement that the High Court has jurisdiction
mm-hmm.
on these matters. And secondly, he has already made a determination that the matter is now urgent, and the ZEC will be told on Monday that they should release the results forthwith, or they have to make a case to say that their work has not been completed.
So do you expect that the presidential results will be released next week?
I think so. That's what I think, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that would be that would at least answer some of these questions.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Now, the other thing is that Morgan Tsvangirai has called for a general strike to be on Tuesday of this week, and I wanted to get from your evaluation how you think what the purpose of that is and what it's going to be accomplished.
Yeah, because traditionally this is entrenched in our constitution and in our labor laws. Workers have the right to strike. Mm-hmm. And they, over the years, they've been striking on labor issues. You know, they want more salaries, or the conditions of service are not good, and they make, you know, there is collective bargaining mm-hmm. That involves workers, employers, and government. What has been happening was that the opposition party has been using the instrument of workers' strikes for mm-hmm. political purposes.
Right.
Now, and this is the latest example of a strike being called for political
right.
purposes,
right.
Not for labor purposes.
Right.
In the past, such strikes have not succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
The workers did not heed the call for strikes, and in fact, they wanted to. At one stage, the strategy they called the last push. The last push. Mm-hmm. They wanted there to be a nationwide strike, and to make the country ungovernable,
right.
so that there is. A revolution from the streets, like what happened in Eastern Europe, where you had the
right.
is it the Orange Revolution or these color revolutions? They were calling for that
right.
in Zimbabwe, and it did not succeed.
Well, I could also add that last week, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a big think tank here in the United States that works with the British. One of the representatives, who's so-called expert on Zimbabwe, said, well, the opposition party has no leverage except to make the country ungovernable. That's their leverage. And, of course, that's what Raila Odinga did in Kenya, which destroyed the country. Kenya is now in a qualitatively worse state than it's ever been in since British rule. And that, I think, is one of the plans they have for Zimbabwe, is to make the country ungovernable.
Yes, that would suit very well the British policy of regime change. But now that you mentioned Kenya, I need to say that there is a difference here.
Yes, I know.
As far as the British are concerned, and Kenya was a British colony, it doesn't really matter if it is Raila Odinga in power or Mwai Kibaki. Both of them are very close allies
yes.
of the British.
Yes.
In Zimbabwe, it is different.
Yes.
We are talking of two different paradigms of development. On the one hand, you have a puppet party which takes instructions from London,
correct.
The MDC,
right.
and is funded by London.
Yes.
And on the other, you have the party of nationalists that spearheaded the liberation war
right.
and is saying that the indigenous people should also have a say in the ownership of land and the mineral resources. They cannot just continue to be laborers
right.
in the mines of the British
right.
Or on British farms. So
these
are two diametrically opposed paradigms of development.
That's correct.
Yes.
Portia, did you want to join in?
Yeah, I mean, I can just say what really gets me worked up a lot is, you know, this type of underlying tenor, you know, in the propaganda against Zimbabwe, for example, where they always, you know, they insinuate, you know, the all too racist assumption that Africans cannot really deal with competitive commercial farming, you know, because today there's a situation where, you know, many countries are not even self-subsisting food producers in Africa. But then if you would just take, you know, the crazy situation with the global food crisis, really there is no alternative but to develop Africa through massive investments in infrastructure and advanced technologies. You know, I just want to bring attention to this India African Union summit that just took place. You know, Africans have always been farmers, and they know how to farm. The huge plantations that were owned by the whites in Rhodesia, they were run and staffed by Africans. So, I mean, you can't say that Africans cannot farm. And the whole, you know, globalization policy of cash cropping, and it completely ruined most of African countries, because in the last couple of decades, you know, you had to farm, plant things like tobacco or cotton, which you can't eat, and it ruins the soil. So one of the main points that Mrs. Tepler-Rouche outlined in her article that will appear in the next issue of the EIR, she is the leader of the European movement. You know, she talks about how the world really has to double its food production as soon as possible. And that means, you know, this whole biofuel issue has to be just stopped. And it would also mean, as was discussed in India, that more developed countries should go into agreements with African states and start building great projects and infrastructure, exactly like what Russia and China is doing. So instead, you know, of the EU or you know, the U.S. government grumbling about human rights and so on, I see no reason why they should not do this as well. I mean, we're going to need highways, railways, canal systems, you know, to integrate all the land that's to be made available for agriculture production, similar to what Nehru did in the Green Revolution in India. And here's a key issue that's very important for Africa, because most of the farming is dependent on rainfall. And if there's no rain, then, you know, that's it. And to alleviate the situation, we need nuclear power, you know, especially the fourth generation pebble bed reactor that's being built in South Africa right now, because it's safe, inherently safe, but it's also perfect for the desalination of water. And we need water management systems, power systems. We have serious energy shortages, especially in Zimbabwe, but, you know, in all of Africa. And as Mrs. LaRouche also points out in her article, the best way and the cheapest way to safeguard crops is nuclear radiation. You know, it keeps away pests and diseases like, you know, environmentalists and things like that. So, you know, at this point, I can, you know, hear what most people are thinking that are listening right now. They say, oh, you know, it's very nice, you know, what you're saying, but it'll take forever and it's a total fantasy. You know, but I don't think so, because in a maneuver, the German Defense Forces, the German Bundeswehr, can build a bridge across the River Rhine in 45 minutes. And if you could have something like an Army Corps of Engineers that could come in with the consent of the African government and a crash program, you know, you train the people to do it on their own. And I think there's a new determination of African countries to take their destiny in their own hands. This impulse is really very strong. The problem is they're not getting any help from the West, and this is something that is a question of political will. We are blessed in Africa with the richest soils you can ever imagine. We could have four harvests in a year. You know, you mentioned Sudan and Zimbabwe. It's the same, you know. So what we need is, you know, this issue of these projects that the LaRouches have been discussing for a very long time. And you know, as a young African, as a young Zimbabwean, what I would wish is to turn, you know, these barren and arid areas in Africa, turn them into blooming gardens. And you know, in that sense, I do admit I'm a real greenie, as they are called here. You know, because I know the only way to do it is with nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be, you know, the issue that should be brought up, you know. And, you know, I'd be interested to hear what Dr. Mapranga has to say about that.
Yeah, about a minute.
Yeah, well, I think I agree entirely with what she has said. But then you have a situation where if the Bush administration arrogates to itself the power to say who should have access to nuclear technology,
right,
and who should not.
Right.
That's a big problem. So that's a big problem. And she mentioned the question of agriculture being dependent on rains. Well, that is true in most Africa. In Zimbabwe, we have just realized that we realized that we now have a ministry of water development, and which is concerned with building dams and sinking boreholes and for irrigation purposes. So I agree entirely with her analysis.
Well, I think that we've had quite an educational show. We want to thank Portia from Berlin. We want to thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for coming to our studios. This is the LaRue Show on April 12th, 2008. We hope people could find out more by going to the internet, laRouchePub.com or laRouchePAC.com to find out more information on our campaigns against the British and for the defense of the African nations. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.